Good afternoon. Can I welcome you all to the 27th Chorley Lecture? This is a lecture series established by the Modern Law Review to commemorate its first general editor, Lord Chorley of Kendal, who was for some years a professor of commercial law here in the school. Today's speaker, Anthony Giddins, is currently the director of the LSE. But I think it's fair to say that that's not why we've invited him to speak. Our principal reason for asking him to speak is simply this, that over the past 20 years, Anthony Giddins has established himself as one of the leading contemporary social theorists in the world. His list of publications is so long that were I even to attempt to summarize it, we would be here for at least another 15 minutes before we got going, so I won't do that. But suffice it to say that not only is his own list of publications so long, it's so influential that something like 12 books have been published about his work, in addition to the much larger number of books he himself has produced. In addition to this energetic publishing career, he's also well known, perhaps to many of you, as one of the founders of Polity Press, and therefore as a successful academic entrepreneur, one might say, in his own right. Since coming to the LSE, his impact has been felt in many areas already. But I think it's appropriate to refer to one particular area where his directorship so far has stood out as being unusual. And that is, if I make brief reference to what I think we can only call the cult status that already has been acquired by the lecture series which he has given in the school so far each year to a wide audience, including undergraduates. This is a rather unusual phenomenon for a director of the LSE in these very difficult times. And I think that looking long ahead into the future, this lecture series will be one of the things for which his directorship will be remembered. Now, his topic today has the elegant title, Risk and Responsibility. And without taking up any more of your time, let me introduce Anthony Giddins.
Well, thanks very much, Tim, for that generous introduction. You all like you're sitting on some curious privatized railway carriage or something. Just see everyone's head sticking out above these chairs. If I was a filmmaker, it made a very good scene. Can everyone hear me at the back if I speak this? Well, let me say how pleased I am anyway to be asked to give the Chorley Lecture this year, and how honoured I am to follow in the footsteps of Antonio Cazzese, because I've long been an admirer of his, and Polity Press, to which Tim referred, I'm pleased to say, was the first press to translate Cazzese's work. We translated, I think, at least two of his books into English. I feel I should start this lecture with a couple of qualifications, because I'm no longer an academic, I'm an apparatchik. Therefore, I'm not sure that I've got a great deal to say. It's very hard to keep up with the academic literature in this job, so I hope you'll look tolerantly on me. Second, I'm not a lawyer, and I know a bit about the sociology of law, and particularly Max Weber, but I hope you'll forgive me if I don't talk directly about the law, but talk about some themes that I hope are of interest to lawyers, and if we do have a little time for discussion afterwards, it might be useful to see if any of the themes that I talk about do tease out any responsibilities. Any responses about responsibility, which might then help establish some kind of dialogue. The theme of what I want to talk about really is change. The background, I think anyway, to looking at the concepts of risk and responsibility is a world in change. Many people think, and I tend to agree with them, that this period in human history is a period of probably as radical change as that which occurred around the end of the 18th century, which initiated the emergence of modern industrial society. I think to get a grasp of the changes transforming our lives is crucial to understanding why the notion of risk, or at least I want to suggest the notion of risk, is peculiarly interesting for us in the social sciences at this time, and why also the notion of risk is tied to changing conceptions of responsibility. I think we know pretty well what are the big changes transforming the world. What we can be much less sure of is what their consequences will be for us and for the society in which we live. Let me begin by just sketching out what I take these changes to be. There are three big changes, I think, which are transforming society, not just in the United Kingdom, not just in Europe, but to a large degree through the world. The first is the impact of that by now notorious set of changes now labeled globalization. Globalization, I think, is perhaps the fundamental agenda of the social sciences at the end of the 20th century. Now, history of the term globalization is very interesting. Only about 10 years ago, the term globalization was hardly used. I wrote a book in, I think, 1989, Consequences of Modernity, in which I used the term globalization, but that at that time, the word was by no means established in the social science literature. Now, quite amazingly, the word globalization is everywhere. It's no longer just a social science term. It's come right into the forefront of popular discourse. Hardly a speech from Tony Blair is complete without a mention of globalization. You open your average in-flight magazine, you find that the term globalization and business and so forth appears there. The term is used in the newspapers regularly from day to day. It might be the most successful social science term in recent times. Now, because the term globalization has become so familiar, and because it is a kind of unlovely word, I think, there is a strong reaction to it. Those of you who follow the literature on these things will know that already that literature divides into two. There is a very intense controversy over what globalization is and whether what it means at the end of the 20th century. On the one hand, you have the writings of those who are skeptical of the whole idea, now known in the literature with an appropriate label, the globalization skeptics. The key text for the globalization skeptics is Paul Hurst and Paul Thompson, Globalization in Question. I'm allowed to say this, also a book published by Polity Press, but not views I fully agree with. Globalization skeptics tend to come from the left. They tend to argue that the world at the end of the 20th century looks very similar to the world at the end of the 19th century. They say, well, Eddie, in the late 19th century, there were very extensive world trading relationships. There was a very intense currency and gold exchange market. You had pretty liberal world markets at that time. You didn't even have passports before sort of fairly late on in the 19th century. What's new is their claim. The current period of globalization is no different from what's existed in the past. Therefore, the reason why this appeals to many people on the left is you can simply say, oh, well, nations still have the power they used to have. The welfare state can still remain intact and so forth. On the other side, there are people who take almost completely opposite view, who are now widely known as the hyper-globalizers. These terms were invented by David Held, a colleague of mine also from Cambridge. The hyperglobalizers say the opposite. They say globalization has already advanced so far that the nation states become obsolete, politicians have become impotent, the world was becoming ruled by city states rather than nations, and globalization refers to the creation of a borderless world. Now, it's not my role in this lecture really to comment in detail on this controversy, except I just want to stake a few claims. I think the globalization skeptics are decisively wrong and have been shown to be wrong by recent accumulation of empirical material. The current period is very, very different from anything in the past. It's led by the impact of global electronic technology. The way to think of what's happening in the world is not just to think of globalization as the economic marketplace. It's not just that. It's really a transformation in the way we live. It's led by the impact of electronic communication systems, and it's simply changing the very texture of our lives, which is why it's very relevant to risk in a way which I'll mention in a moment. The globalization skeptics are therefore, I think, wrong. The hyperglobalizers are also wrong, I think, because rather than living in a world where globalization is complete, we're living in a world where it's still in its early stages. What we're seeing, I think, is the emergence of something like a global cosmopolitan society, not created by political will, as Marx envisaged, but created by the twin forces of the expansion of market capitalism worldwide following the collapse of the Soviet Union and a raft of technological changes associated with that. Think of globalization then not as something out there, not as sort of large-scale systems in the world, but something like a complete transformation of the basic social institutions in which we live, running all the way through from emotional life, family life, sexuality, gender, work, right the way through welfare state systems, transformation of government itself, up to the global order. This is a massive, massive period of change, a complex of forces really involved in this. Second, linked to the impact of globalization, a shift in the nature of the economy and the technological forces driving that economy. Baldly put, one can say, following the writings of Danny Quah at the LSE, there is emerging a global weightless economy or dematerialized economy, driven by many factors, of course, but driven importantly by the impact of information technology. You can even date the emergence of the weightless economy in a way. You can say the weightless economy began in 1981 because that was a year at which in the US expenditure on information technology industries outstripped expenditure on traditional manufacturing industries. Information technology, of course, has completely transformed manufacture. It's helped destroy Fordism. It's also helped destroy the traditional class structure on which so many political and other forms in Western society were based. In most Western countries, you have less than 20% of the population working in traditional manufacturing occupations, down to about 16% in Norway, for example. It's not just an American phenomenon, this is a more or less universal phenomenon in Western societies. A tremendous concatenation of changes involved with that. Third, no less important in my view anyway, and again absolutely crucial for the themes of risk and responsibility, tremendous changes on the level of everyday life, which one can refer to, again put perhaps too baldly, but one can refer to as the retreat of tradition and custom in people's lives. The retreat of tradition and custom is partly the causal consequence of globalization, because globalization, forces of globalization tend to invade local contexts of action, transform them, and force people to live differently, whether they want to or not. A society marked by the retreat of tradition and custom is a society marked by increasing reflexivity, where reflexivity means the use of information coming from the outside world as a means of organizing one's life using that information not just as an environment of one's life, but as constitutive of what one's life actually is. A society where tradition and custom loses its hold is a society, if you put it the other way round, where we no longer live our lives as fate. Even a generation ago, I think you could say that, for example, gender divisions in Western society, there was a strong element of custom, tradition, and fate attached to being born as a man as compared to being born as a woman. If you take the institution of marriage, marriage was still strongly institutionalized. There were clear gender roles linked to it. Your fate, if you're a woman, was normally to have a family, bring up children, concentrate your life in the domestic milieu. Again, with some gross oversimplification, you can say this. For men, your fate was to be involved in the labor force, to get educated if you could, to work through your life, to retire, and to expire. That was the male fate. These things are no longer true. It is no longer true that gender fixes one's identity in this way. It is no longer true that marriage is any longer an institutionalized phenomenon in the way in which it was a generation ago. For better or for worse, as one might say, the structure of marriage now is a symbolic sign of commitment in relationships rather than an institutionalized segregation of roles. Of course, this doesn't apply universally. There's a generic trend, which is again not just limited to Western societies, but is becoming global in its impact. Detraditionalization is a globalizing phenomenon itself. It affects our lives not just in our personal emotional lives, but it affects, for example, our relationship to politics. If you ask why politicians are less popular than they used to be, if you ask why there are so many corruption trials and so forth around the world, this is much to do with the fact that politicians now live in the same information environment as the rest of the population. An open information environment demands a different form of legitimation in politics from that which existed previously, where all sorts of monopolies of information were possible through the holding of political power. Much the same also applies to economic power too. The electronic currency marketplace is perhaps the prime example of electronic interchange determining so much of our lives, where everybody is in principle in possession of exactly the same information. Not only are they in principle and often in practice in possession of the same information, they know that everybody else is in possession of the same information too. Currency markets are highly complex, reflexive forms of organization of human expectations about other expectations. I think George Soros is right to say that the currency markets are therefore don't tend towards equilibrium because they depend upon a reflexive understanding, if I can put it this way, of other people's reflexive understanding of your own reflexivity. These things are formalized in risk scenarios. For anyone who knows anything about derivatives or futures markets, they're extraordinarily interesting because what they are a kind of risk-based construction of the future. Derivative is essentially risk-based on risk-based on risk-based on risk as a way of constructing a mathematically formulated future scenario. These things, therefore, then lead me into my main theme for this lecture, a theme of the tide and interesting relationship between risk and responsibility. In this world of dramatic social change, economic change, political change, the notion of risk becomes central to us in a way which I'll try to explicate. But at the same time, the structure of risk changes. We face many new risk environments, which I think one can say no one has had to face before, not in the same form anyway. As we face new risk environments, and as we do so as a reflexive citizenry, I feel our notions of responsibility must change and are changing. There is an intrinsic tie between risk and responsibility, I think, because, as I'll explain in a minute, risk refers to open futures. Risk refers to a future which we seek deliberately to construct. Responsibility refers to the same thing, or can be construed to refer to the same decision-making matrix of a constructed future. Let me fill in a little background to this, just by sketching out why the notion of risk is so interesting and a little bit about its history. To me, once you just sort of get to grips with it, it is an extraordinarily absorbing notion, the notion of risk. And one way to show this is to trace back its history. The notion of responsibility is relatively recent, as you'll probably know, only seems to date from about 1780 when it was first used as a term, responsibility. The word responsible has a longer history. The term risk is also relatively recent. It dates from a little earlier than this. But if you look at the anthropology of risk, it seems that by and large, most traditional cultures do not have a notion of risk. And it's, so far as we know, the Middle Ages had no notion of risk. Why? Because after all, everyone knows the Middle Ages were pretty dangerous and risky time. Life was, after all, nasty, brutish, and short in the Middle Ages for most people. Why was there no notion of risk? There was no notion of risk because risk is a term which concerns a society which orients itself towards the future and which has a particular view of the future, which is the view associated only with modernity. If you live in a fairly traditional society, tradition gears you to the future through the past. If you live in a world where tradition is fate and it sets most of what you do, you don't need a notion of risk, nor do you have a notion of risk. A notion of risk only emerges when you start to think of the future, as is characteristic of modernity, as a sort of territory to be colonized, to be occupied, if you like, by the shock troops of modernity, such that we can control the future and subordinate it to human purposes. It's only when you get such an open view of the future that the term risk starts to be used. Interestingly, so far as I could trace anyway, the term risk was first used by explorers, adventurers, to refer to uncharted waters as they made their journeys across the world. Uncharted waters is a spatial concept, but it was soon transferred to be the uncharted waters of the future. The point about the notion of risk, however, is it allows you to try and chart the future. So it's not surprising that the notion of risk rapidly became transferred to the economic sphere. In the Middle Ages, then, if something happens to you, well, it's fate, it's God's will, it's just how things are, this is how the world is, tough luck. A correlate of the rise of risk, which ties it closely to responsibility and to the law, is the notion of insurance. Ideas of insurance do go back a long way, but the generalization of insurance is again a creation of modernity. And why? Well, because insurance is also about future time. Insurance is a way of trying to lock in future time into the present so that you can control the future in order to control the present. Max Weber made this point. The modern capitalist enterprise is only possible through having a calculable future. That's the difference between modern capitalism and traditional capitalist systems. Calculability means having some secure hold of the future, where the future is not like the past. Crucial feature of modernity, of course, is that many areas the future is not like the past. You try to control it through it being, as it were, not like the past. So the notions of risk and insurance are very closely tied. And they're tied, and I think, in a very sort of interesting way, because, for example, my daughter worked in Russia recently. She started working in Russia not long after the 1989 revolutions, or whatever you would like to call them. And she found that many of the things that we routinely
think you can get insurance for. You couldn't get insurance for in Russia at that time. So that if you lose your bags on the train, you couldn't get insurance for that. If you lose your bags, it's just tough luck. That's how things are. That's your lot. You simply accept your lot. Now, I'd like to point out to you an interesting relationship between risk, responsibility, and welfare, because the idea of the welfare state, the idea of security, the idea of safety, they're all bound up with the rise of the notion of risk. You don't have those ideas as secular ideas until some way through the 18th century. And you should notice, I think, what a metaphysical assumption it is that we can make the world secure. Previous civilizations have never thought this, or they thought security came from the hand of God. For modernity, this no longer applies. The rise of the welfare state, therefore, as François Ewald points out in what's probably the best book on the welfare state, L'État-providence, never been translated, but it's a brilliant book on the welfare state, points out the generalization of the idea of risk goes along with the generalization of the idea of security and goes along with the notion of protection. That is, that it's not only the right of people to be protected, but it is factually possible for a society to protect its citizenry against a diversity of contingencies, which in all other cultures are simply presumed to be part of natural hazard. By the way, the difference between danger and risk is that risk refers to dangers which are actively confronted in a calculated way in a proposed future. Risk, of course, always involves danger, but danger as such is not the same as risk. These things trace out, the early relationship between risk, security, safety, welfare, with the early period of the rise of modern industrial civilization. They, of course, bring a whole legal apparatus with them. The structure of the law traces out these concepts. There are, of course, notions of liability built into this structure. I must say, I think also the idea of safety is very intriguing. The idea of what a safe environment is, it seems, you know, sort of us to be obvious. We should always have safe industrial environments, for example. We should try and have safe roads. We should try and have safe drugs. We should try and have safe food. The idea of safety is much more complex, though, than appears at first sight, I think, when you puzzle it through. Don't have time to talk about it, really, but it's not easy in practice to decide what safety actually means. But again, it seems to carry a certain metaphysic of a controllable world, a humanly controllable world. After all, one of the driving dynamics of modernity. Now, what I'd like to propose to you is that although this tracks out the background to the early relationship between risk, security, welfare in the early phases of the development of modern industrial society, with the impact of the changes I described at the beginning, the three sets of big transformations affecting our lives, the tissue and nature of risk is changing. That as risk environments change, so conceptions of security, safety, responsibility, liability will change along with them. What are these changes? Well, I try to encapsulate them, I'm not sure how successfully, in a distinction between what I call external risk or external uncertainty and manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty. It's itself a relatively crude, but I hope helpful distinction. External risk is risk, if you consider, just stick for the moment to the realm of nature, external risk is risk which comes from either the given properties of nature or from the fixed properties of human institutions and traditional modes of action. External risk environments are easily described in relation to nature. They concern the worries that people always had about nature for hundreds of years. People always worried about what nature could do to them. As you probably know, it's only more or less the last 100 years that people have loved to have learned to admire and love mountains, for example, or learned to admire the seaside. People in previous generations thought of these as inhospitable risk environments, some of the worst aspects of inhospitable nature. For hundreds of years, people worried about the risks coming from nature, risks of floods, risks of bad harvests, risks of plagues, risks of many diverse kinds associated with the malign impact of nature. Of course, nature has a bountiful side too. External risk is basically risk which is, as it were, taken for granted as a feature of one's life. If you consider our relationship to nature, it's only, I think, relatively recently, and it's very much led by the impact of the changes I previously described, that we started thinking about nature in a different way. It's only about the last 30 or 40 years that we started, particularly in the West, worrying less about what nature can do to us and worrying more about what we've done to nature. Once you make that transition, you're moving from a world of external risk to a world in which manufactured risk has a greater prominence. By manufactured risk, I mean risk which derives from the intrusion of human knowledge into the environments which that knowledge constitutes. In the realm of nature, this of course means the impact of science and technology and the changes which science and technology have generated for us. Manufactured risk environments, I'll suggest a bit later, have different qualities from external risk environments. One of these qualities is that they're very difficult to insure. Insurance mechanisms and liability mechanisms normally depend upon actuarial calculations. You can make actuarial calculations when you have time series data. So an insurance company, for example, on the basis of at least current trends, can calculate what your pension rights might be if you invest a certain amount of money. Or it can calculate what risk you run of being involved in a car accident every time you drive your car on the roads or indeed walk along the streets where other people are driving cars. The new risk environments do not admit of actuarial calculation. There are, as it were, new frontiers in human history, I think. If you can't make actuarial calculations, it's very hard to allocate responsibility in the way in which that traditional tie has been involved in insurance mechanisms, whether these be individual insurance mechanisms or the insurance mechanisms of the welfare state, because I like to insist one should look on the welfare state as essentially a risk management system. What the welfare state is a pooled risk management system where the investment you make is not directly related to the coverage which you receive. That's why it's redistributive, because it doesn't have the same direct insurance component which contributory insurance does. Contributory insurance, when you link what you pay to the coverage you actually get. In welfare state mechanisms, we reserve various forms of universal coverage against risks, even though we may pay the same or we may be covered by paying less if you have a progressive tax system than the more affluent pay. Let's look a bit more at the characteristics of manufactured risk environments. Ecological risks are a prime case of manufactured risk environments, but I want to say that such environments are also social. They apply to many aspects of our lives, including, for example, the changes affecting marriage, the upbringing of children, the family, and so forth. These are also, if you go back to the primitive metaphor, uncharted waters for us. One of the things that happens in new style risk environments is that there is also a new dialogue between us as laypersons and science and technology, a dialogue which I feel is very consequential for risk and responsibility connections. I think you could say that for previous generations in Western countries, science functioned as a sort of quasi-tradition. You allowed scientists to get on with their work. You consulted them when you needed their advice. They would tell you what the quote truth unquote was, so that if you got ill, you turned to a medical specialist. In current circumstances, where through the globalization of science and technology, the impact of science and technology is so immediate and so pervasive on our lives, after all, it affects immediately what we eat in our everyday food consumption, you cannot treat science and technology as insulated environments. Therefore, all of us are engaged in a continuing dialogue with science and technology, and all of us discover, especially in new style risk environments, that that dialogue is open, it's uncertain, and it's mutable. If you could put it this way, in the context of the LSE, all of us as lay people are discovering what Karl Popper taught as a technical philosophy of science a generation before. Popper argued, correctly I think, that science does not accumulate truth, that science is an uncertain, skeptical enterprise, that the logic of science is driven by critical reason, that science has no foundations, that it's built on shifting sand. The only difference between science and myth, Popper said, is that science is myth with a critical core. That kind of world is an uncomfortable world to be in. There's no way out, however, of a dialogic engagement with it, so far as I can see. Therefore, every time you decide what to eat, for example, for your breakfast or your dinner, you're involved willy-nilly in a debate with the ongoing scientific claims about the impact of food on health, for instance. There's no way out of that debate. You can, of course, choose to ignore it. You can say, I'm going to eat chips no matter what the scientists claim. You can point to the fact that a generation ago, butter and red meat and cream were supposed to be good for us, whereas now they're harmful for us. You could point out that pasta a generation ago made us fat and now mysteriously it makes us thin. Well, this is what an encounter with science and technology is like. It's a world, if you like, of radical skepticism, which affects most of our lives in a very direct way. It also affects identity, emotion, the self, because these things are no longer simply constituted and given. We have a much more open relationship to our identities, our relationships, our emotions than any generation previously had before. This is the background to many of the changes affecting how we cope with risk and how we then relate responsibility to it. In a world increasingly dominated by manufactured risk or manufactured uncertainty, there's not only a new relationship with science and technology, there is, as it were, a new moral climate of politics, which also has important connotations for responsibility. It shifts, if you like, the whole sort of axes of the debate about what responsibility is. I would describe this as a kind of push and pull between scaremongering and cover-ups. Where you have many new risk environments because of the pace and globalization of science and technology and other social changes, such changes always carry new risks. Those risks always, and often very quickly, have to be conveyed to the public. If you're a politician, you have a crucial set of decisions to take. How will you communicate new risks? What will you inform the public about them? When will you inform the public? And what dangers will you claim those risks bring in their train? I'd like to at least suggest to you that there is no wholly democratic, nor is there a wholly rational way of coping with the dilemmas involved. The BSE crisis is a perfect example of this, because BSE, rather than being regarded as a kind of failure of the Tory government, should be regarded as a prototypical new type risk environment. It's prototypical of the new style risks which we have to deal. If you get some amount of evidence that BSE in cattle can produce very serious illness in human beings, as a politician, you have to decide when to announce this. If you decide to announce it too early, and the risk either proves to be non-existent or much less than you wanted to claim, then of course you will be accused of scaremongering. However, if you announce it too late and you wait too long, and there does turn out to be substantial evidence of that connection, you'll be accused of a cover-up. Why didn't you inform us? Why didn't you bring this into the public domain? So far as I can see, there is no rational way of adjudicating between these two sides. It would be good if there were, but it seems to me characteristic of new risk environments that there is not. There are also high levels of reflexivity involved in all this, so therefore the attribution of responsibility is very problematic. There are many circumstances in which you want to scare people so that behavior will be initiated which removes or lessens the situation you wanted to scare them about. Ecological risks are again prototypical for this. To avoid global warming, you've got to worry people about it. To worry them about it, you must bring home the urgency of the risks. In truthfulness, no one knows what the risks are. It's characteristic of new risk environments that the risks are often denied by an important body of scientific or lay opinion. It's characteristic of these risk environments that the very existence of risk is denied. However, you often have to proceed as though it were real. You often have to scare people to get the consequences you want, but you can't scare people all the time. You can't scare people in too many domains. There is a fatigue which sets in when you're told too many times about the dangers of global warming. All these are part of a reflexive information environment. You should notice other sort of twists and turns in this kind of story, which certainly affect liability and responsibility. If you take the case of AIDS, whether this is a real scenario or not, I'm not entirely sure, but in the case of AIDS, you want to scare people into changing their sexual behavior. So you want, certainly, to make them very worried about the consequences of certain types of sexual acts. Now, supposing you do scare them, and they do change their behavior, and the incidence of AIDS is much lower than it otherwise would be, they will say, scaremongering. Why were you alarming us so much about a phenomenon which has turned out to be of much less importance than you originally claimed? This, I would propose to you, for those who follow the debate, is the kind of Sunday Times reaction, as Sunday Times at one point published a whole series of articles about us all being worried unnecessarily about the spread of AIDS. There are many risk-type environments in a highly reflexive information-type economy in which the scenarios are different from the past, where you have no actuarial way of calculating risk, where you get this very twisted story of the relationship between the announcement of scientific, technological, or other findings and the consequences of those findings. This is something we all have to wrestle with, I think. As lawyers, you would have to, but politicians and lay people have to also. Finally, in this sort of brief tour d'horizon about risk, one of the reasons I'm trying to suggest to you why the notion of risk is so unifying and important to us is that we have become an even more radically future-oriented society than was ever true before, particularly through the decline of custom and tradition under the impact of globalization and higher technological change. That's why risk is such a key notion for us. However, one must recognize that there are two sides to risk, and they're both bound up with the impact of manufactured risk, especially in the late modern world. And interestingly, there are two quite discrepant literatures on risk. I'm trying to get a new risk program started in the LSE, actually. We got some funding for this from the Michael Peacock Foundation, which would try to bring together these two literatures and as it were, two sides of risk. On the one hand, there's a literature in which risk is fundamentally negative, as you might expect it to be. The point of this literature is risk management in order to minimize risk. This is a kind of treatment of risk you find in ecological literature, for example, mostly in the literature of the welfare state, mostly in health risk and other areas. There is another literature, however, in which the notion of risk is perceived completely differently. This is literature of finance, investment, and the mechanics of wealth generation in a globalized market society. In that kind of society, it can quite accurately be argued risk is an energizing notion. Risk is an energizing feature, not just an energizing feature, the energizing feature of a globalizing capitalist economy, exposed in its most naked form in global financial markets. Risk there is not something to be avoided, it is something to be cultivated. The taking of risks is crucial to economic success. Entrepreneurial activity is crucial to the prosperity of a globalized capitalist economy. But risk taking would also be crucial, I think, to the reaction of labor forces, not just to the owners of capital, but to the purveyors of labor. You need a labor force which takes risks, which doesn't just remain in secure environments if you're going to have a prosperous economy. And you also need a positive, energetic attitude to risk, I think, in everyday life. I think the best way of studying emotional change in modern society is through therapy manuals, self-help manuals. Everyone used to think it's just a Californian thing, but now it's a universal thing. In a reflexive society where tradition and custom don't guide you in the same way as they used to do, and your granny isn't a useful source of wisdom to you, you go to therapy manuals. Self-help manuals and self-help groups are a kind of reflexive engagement with our emotional lives on the ground. Now, a really interesting feature of therapy books, self-help groups, is exactly an emphasis on risk. You find that most self-help groups, self-help manuals, and self-help groups emphasize, as it were, risk-taking. What they say is don't just stick with established routines. Take the chance to change your life. You can see the relevance of this, whatever banalities there may be in it, to the world of relationships, I think. We are now in a world where only a small minority of people stay married for life. Only a small minority do, and so far as we know, only a small minority will. This is therefore a world where you have to make transitions through relationships. Not only do you have to make transitions through relationships, but you have to form relationships in a very active manner. What is a relationship for us is not institutionalized in the way in which it used to be. It has to be continually made, worked upon. It is something which you have to do. You have to give of yourself to sustain a closed emotional relationship, whether it's in marriage or whether it's in friendship or elsewhere. What you're describing here is therefore an active risk environment in which the ability to take risks, the preparedness to take risks, the preparedness, for example, of a woman to leave a destructive relationship, for example, a physically violent relationship, is crucial to that woman's happiness and autonomy. The notion of risk, therefore, is a positive notion, an energizing notion, in our emotional life, just as it is in financial markets. And of course, anyone who's enjoyed skiing, for example, will know that risk has this attractive side to it, which gives you a direct emotional buzz. It's not just a matter of sort of energizing feature of risk. These things then lead me to reach a certain number of conclusions, or at least, I haven't left enough time, but just to mention then a few puzzles and areas of interest for responsibility. The notion of risk I've tried to suggest is intrinsically tied to responsibility. The two notions rise together with modernity. The changes I'm describing are altering both of them, so far as I can see anyway. So I noted down sort of four brief points about what might be said to be happening to responsibility, without, I have to say, knowing what the lawyers are. I'm sure you maybe have been through all this already, but what the lawyers are saying and how you enshrine this in legal practice. First, in a society of new risk environments, there seems to be a major problem with what Ulrich Beck calls organized irresponsibility. Organized irresponsibility is not personal irresponsibility. It is not the irresponsibility of someone who deserts his or her wife or children without providing any income for them. It is not psychological irresponsibility. It is organized irresponsibility, where you cannot trace out the consequences of a sequence of changes, partly because you actually can't do the risk calculations for them. Many situations of ecological risk are like this, partly because they're bound up with these highly reflexive risk environments, partly because the level of risk is not known, partly because, of course, surely there are so many elements involved in scenarios of ecological risk. It's very hard to trace out responsibility. Let me give you an example. I don't know if you know the book. I know it because I reviewed it. The only other thing I get to do these days is review books, really. The book by Corborn and others called Our Stolen Future. Our Stolen Future claims that many pathological phenomena affecting the human body and the animal world are the result of the use of pesticides and chemicals in the environment. There's some very compelling and disturbing evidence in it, linking these, for example, to what appears to be a radical decline in male fertility in many countries in the world, human male fertility, and possibly also to the rise of breast cancer in women across the world and other forms of cancer in men. Now, it's a perfect example of a new risk environment. First of all, if you read the book, you absolutely cannot work out whether or not it's true. It seems plausible, highly disturbing, but you also cannot puzzle out responsibility. There is actually nowhere in the world where these pesticides do not exist. They went to the far reaches of Alaska, and they studied people who used to be called Eskimos, and then were called Inuit, and now called something else, but who live up there. And they found they were more contaminated, their bodies were more contaminated with the chemical residues than actually people living in Western urban environments are. Supposing these risks are real, as they might very well be, who is to take responsibility for them? I don't think there is any clear answer to that question. It would not simply be the welfare state, I don't think. It would not be traditional medical institutions. It's not easy. I can't see easily how these things can be captured in law. Nevertheless, any individual company, of course, who was accused of using pesticides, if pesticides were banned, it would be a very different situation. But they are not banned. It's a risk environment which we don't know much about. It's a very serious one. There seems no clear attribution of responsibility. Second, there seems to me interesting set of areas around responsibility concerning the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle is the main principle which ecological theorists use to deal with overall attributions of responsibility in the kind of environments of change I'm describing. The precautionary principle says don't interfere with nature unless you have very good reason to do so. Would imply that in mad cow disease, it was a mistake, bad mistake, for cows to be fed food which was composed of other animals, not of the natural diet which cows eat. However, I think myself, I don't know what you think, but I think the precautionary principle is incoherent. I don't see any way of formulating it as a general principle of practice, let alone law, because in many risk environments, you can't specify what nature is. nature has already been so transformed that you're deeply into the world of the non-natural. There is no way back to the world of the natural. Even, I think, organic farming is not natural. Organic farming is a very specific, organized response to some of the changes that people think are happening, farming practices. You therefore have to make a decision about two forms of non-nature. So I don't see that there is a generalizable precautionary principle. So you can't really rescue the theme of responsibility by reference to such a principle. At least I don't see how one can as a general phenomenon. Third, it seems to me in this world there is a shifting balance between individual and collective responsibility, which is very interesting, difficult to puzzle through, but somehow crucial. This is clearly very strongly involved in the debate about the welfare state. If the welfare state is a collective risk management system, as I think plainly it is, the management of risk in the welfare state used to be assumed, I think, as external risk. Mostly it was assumed you get ill, welfare state will care for you. You get unemployed, the welfare state will care for you. Get disabled, the welfare state will look after you. Get divorced, the welfare state will step in. You get abandoned, the welfare state will help you. It's no longer possible, I think, to have welfare systems based on the assumption of external or passive risk. Welfare systems surely now have to recognize the new relationship between reflexivity and risk, and have to recognize that it doesn't make any sense any longer simply to, for example, treat unemployment or divorce as simply phenomena of external or passive risk, nor health either. You have to have a more active notion of responsibility, and you surely have to have a world, however we achieve it, where individuals and collectivities take more responsibilities for future-oriented actions. Now, we know where some of the dilemmas around this lead. For example, the dilemma of what you do about smokers. Are surgeons right who refuse to treat people who won't give up smoking, for example? Should collective insurance provide for certain types of active risk engagement where reflexively you can be presumed to know that risk engagement will be harmful? Should you recast responsibility so as to release the state partially from it and place more responsibility on the individual? These things are all bound up with a kind of complex and, I think, again, extremely absorbing debate about the future of welfare systems. But to my way of thinking anyway, the main reason for the crisis of the welfare state is not that it's a fiscal crisis, is that it has to readjust itself to cope with a new environment of risk, in which risk is often a positive thing, so that in welfare systems you actually want to encourage people to get into work, for example. Welfare to work debate is debate about the relationship between active risk-taking and security, which shifts the balance between them. Finally, very briefly, all these things deflect back on insurance. I'm sorry to keep saying, I noticed a few cynical smiles. I didn't mean to finish about 10 minutes ago, really. Very, very quickly, these things reflect back on insurance. It seems to me that we're moving towards a notion of what you could describe as responsible risk-taking as the core of liability and insurance. And related to that, we're probably redefining the boundaries of what insurance actually is. A sort of interesting question is whether in the late modern world the idea of modernity, that is that everything can be insured, is any longer sustainable. We can insure more things than anyone could previously, even 20 or 30 years ago. On the other hand, insurance companies are pulling back for insuring certain types of risk. Most of these risks are new style manufactured risk environments. Lloyd's Insurance Company, for example, is pulling back from catastrophic risk insurance. Some risk insurance is now being catered for by derivatives. Derivatives themselves are a form of insurance, I think, but a very different form of insurance from traditional insurance mechanisms. All these things then appear to me to create a kind of nest of interesting puzzles for what responsibility is, and presumably for how responsibility is encoded in law and what the relationship is between the collective responsibility of the state as a purveyor of law and the individual responsibilities of citizens and other security providing agencies such as insurance companies. Thanks very much. There's now time for discussion. I think if anyone is prepared and engaged in a kind of discussion, I could offer them the mic. So anyone who prize themselves out of the first class section of the carriage could sort of come up and talk into the mic, maybe. Otherwise, the acoustics are very bad, apparently, of this room. If no one wants to speak, we're all going off to the sherry party or whatever it is. Do you want to come up here and... The question was about tradition, traditional societies, they surely are not static and so forth. What I'm saying is there are sort of generally put two sets of change I was talking about. One is the early emergence of modern industrial society, which always set itself against tradition. Traditional cultures, of course, changed. And I mean, Edward Shields in his book on tradition sort of describes that very well. Of course, you get lots of changes in traditional societies. Traditions are invented and reinvented, notion of tradition, often rejected by many anthropologists because they feel it's too broad a notion, all that kind of stuff. All that having been said, I still think, as I thought for a long while, that there's a really dramatic change with the origins of modern industrial civilization in the West. It does have a different attitude towards the future. It sets out the future as a phenomenon associated intrinsically with change. You get the rise of the very notion of history. History for us means change, whereas in traditional Chinese historiography, for example, it meant continuity. When we think of history, you think of it starting somewhere behind us, sort of going forward in the front. It's been shown that in many non-Western cultures, people simply don't think like that. So I think there is a big difference there. I think now there's an even bigger difference, I'm trying to argue anyway, in that because of all the changes happening in the world today, the very concept of tradition loses its resonance for us in Western societies. I mean, that's a controversial claim, and it would need a lot longer than I have here to elucidate it. You have to elucidate what the notion of tradition means and why it's no longer coherent. But that's the claim I'd make anyway. I think tradition essentially is a kind of collective ritual phenomenon. What's important about tradition is not that it remains unchanged, but that it lays a certain formulaic claim to truth. I think in the late modern world, tradition tends to become either heritage, kitsch. You can have, to some extent, discursively defended traditions, like you might say, very good to sustain traditions of Oxford and Cambridge and education or whatever, because they're functional for education. Or tradition tends to become embattled, and then it becomes fundamentalism. So I think it tends to fall apart, and I think it's a different kind of scenario from the past. That having been said, of course, there are many societies which are much more firmly wedded to kind of traditional modes of doing things. But you could say all this without using the term tradition at all if you found it more acceptable. And you could chart out some of these changes in a generation as they've affected, for example, marriage in Western societies. So not sure an awful lot depends on the actual term tradition, although I'd still use it in these contexts and would still affirm those arguments, I suppose. I thought someone was going to say something about the law.
Thank you.
So can I, on behalf of the committee and I'm sure all of you, thank Anthony Giddens for a most stimulating address. You're all invited to join the committee for a glass of wine downstairs in the room below, where that should now be ready.